New Women in the Old West, a book looks at settlement and suffrage. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, July 27th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with author Winifred Gallagher about her latest book. It goes beyond the stereotypes of school marms and Old West madams to explore the impact of Western women, including Indigenous women and women of color, on America's march toward gender equality. We look at the social studies standards revision process with a member of the working group. We take a moment to remember the debate skills of legislator David Lust. Plus, we head to the South Dakota Agricultural Museum and listen to first tracks from David Hirschroot. Those stories are coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. Health officials are encouraging South Dakotans to protect themselves from the West Nile virus. The State Department of Health has detected the first human case of the virus so far this mosquito season. The department says the case is a man in his 60s from Walworth County. Josh Clayton is the state epidemiologist. He says it's important to take precautions against mosquito bites.
It's a good idea, you know, those long sleeve, long pants, applying mosquito repellent, things that contain things like DEET or picaridin or oil of lemon eucalyptus, those that have been known in the laboratory to repel mosquitoes and do a good job of it are just a few examples of how you can minimize your risk of West Nile virus.
Clayton says people should contact their doctor or go to the emergency room if they experience severe flu-like symptoms after getting a mosquito bite. For more information on West Nile virus, go to doh.sd.gov. South Dakota has the smallest Jewish population in the country, but the community has temporarily grown as 8 rabbinical students tour Western South Dakota. The group met with local Jews at a Rapid City coffee shop, ran into Jewish tourists at Mount Rushmore, and is having one-on-one meetings with Jews who live in more rural areas. SDPB's Ariel Zions has more.
Back in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, rabbinical student Levi Feldman can take a quick walk to the neighborhood synagogue or kosher store. There are no such stores in South Dakota, and Jews might have to drive hours to the nearest temple.
In Crown Heights, I would say that it sort of comes to you as your environment. It's sort of like there. In South Dakota, you're self-made Jew, and your Judaism is your own experience.
Like other Orthodox Hasidic Jews, Feldman has a beard, dons a kippah, and wears tzitzit, or fringes from a prayer shawl, around his waist. Feldman is part of the Chabad movement, which is known for reaching out to Jews no matter how observant they are. The 24-year-old and his classmates were invited to South Dakota by Mendel Alperowitz, who became South Dakota's only full-time rabbi in 2016. Alperowitz says the tour allows isolated Jews to connect with other Jewish people, and it's helpful for the students since some have never spent time in small Jewish communities.
It's very important for their training, and hopefully it allows them to experience other parts of America and see the different cultures around the country and be able to connect and learn more.
The group is spending more than a week in South Dakota before heading back to Brooklyn. For SDPB, I'm Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
Two companies seeking to build thousands of miles of pipeline across the Midwest are promising the effort will aid rather than hinder the fight against climate change. Some environmental groups remain skeptical. The pipeline would stretch from North Dakota through Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Illinois, potentially transforming the Corn Belt into one of the world's largest corridors for a technology called carbon capture and storage. The projects would capture the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide at ethanol refineries and transport it to sites where it could be buried thousands of feet underground beneath deep geological formations. But that isn't stopping some conservationists from opposing it, raising the chances that the pipelines become another pitched battle between energy companies and environmentalists. For today's weather report, it'll be extremely hot and sunny, with temperatures as high as 105 in the west, and the eastern half will see highs in the 90s. Tonight, it'll cool off in the lows to mid-70s, with partly cloudy skies across the state. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Parents preparing for back to school are learning more about district policies for COVID mitigation, in-person learning, and vaccine reporting. Bart Fancook is the content director for South Dakota News Watch. His reporting is available online at sdnewswatch.org. Today he's joining us from on the phone to open up his reporter's notebook. Bart, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. I appreciate it.
What are some of the key concerns you found in your reporting for districts heading into the fall?
Well, obviously, COVID and the COVID variant are big concerns about new cases arising and the chance that this COVID, which is very highly transmittable, might, cause new breakouts in schools. And the concern over COVID has to be balanced by the strong desire and the effectiveness of in-person learning and the desire by administrators, parents, students, and teachers to get back to face-to-face learning. And so far in South Dakota, it looks like across the board that we found looking at in-person learning, no mask or vaccine requirements. And so they're going to take precautions. But I think that's an attempt to try to bring things as much back to normal as possible, but also with a close eye on any changes that might be needed. And they're remaining flexible at this point.
Yeah, so one of the key concerns is really that children under 12 don't have a vaccine available for them yet. What do we know about that 12 to 17-year-old group, and how many, how prevalent has vaccination been for that group in South Dakota?
Well, so far, South Dakota got off to a great start, as we know, in overall vaccinations and adults, especially older adults, but things have really tapered off and sort of topped off at 53% of the full state being vaccinated. But in children 12 to 17, as of early July, only 14% had received a COVID vaccination, and 32% of the young adults aged 18 to 24 were vaccinated. So there's a long way to go there. And there's concerns that, children could spread the original COVID or the variant among themselves or to teachers. And so I think there's a need to be vigilant in schools and make sensible decisions for individuals and their families, any children or adults who have pre-existing conditions that might put them at higher risk of hospitalization or serious implications. They should still consider mask usage and schools, but at this point, not requiring that.
So there are a lot of different groups that you looked in to find out their requirements or just their recommendation. American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended universal mask usage for these kids. The State Department of Education in their Strong Schools plan is really outlining this idea of how important it is to get in-person learning going on. What else did you learn from, the sort of conglomerate of all these different, research tools and recommendations from experts? How do they all intersect?
Well, we're waiting for new guidelines potentially from the CDC today about mask usage indoors, and that may change the playing field some if they come out and recommend that more people should wear masks indoors. And, of course, the push is on to get people vaccinated because that the medical community believes that there's a low chance of side effects and a great outcome in terms of preventing COVID and the variants. So there's a wait-and-see approach right now. South Dakota has tended to, as we do with many things, that start in more populous areas and move toward the middle of the country. We're in the Great Plains here where maybe we haven't seen the full impact of the COVID variants yet, and I think that's likely. One thing we found in our reporting that was gives a sense of why it's important to prevent COVID in the schools was in the Rapid City School District individually in 2020, either due to illness or quarantines due to COVID that year, students lost 70,000 combined days of learning, and teachers and staff lost about 10,000 working days. Mm-hmm. So I think that number, that learning loss and that loss of interaction, there's a risk of going back in person and not wearing masks and potentially allowing for spread of it of COVID. And that's one of the concerns, is that students will lose learning. And as we know, learning compounds on itself, and it's a progressive process to become as educated as you can. And so that's one of the concerns, is that if new outbreaks do occur, we could have a big learning loss. And that's something that the state plan that you mentioned really references, is trying to help kids and teachers get back to where they were prior to the pandemic so they can then build on that.
Yeah, I had to read those numbers twice, Bart, when I got to them, because we think that there is a sense that, we stayed open, our schools are the ones that people across the country are looking to. And when you look at the number of hours and days that were lost, there's got to be an impact of that, and it's still unfolding. So Bart Fancook is content director for South Dakota Newswatch. His reporting is available online at sdnewswatch.org. He joined us today for Reporter's Notebook. Bart, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Lori. I appreciate it.
Ahead on the program, the process of revising social studies standards. You're listening to In the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Bob Minster established his reputation as a talented tenor saxophonist and composer as a member of the late 1970s Buddy Rich Orchestra. He led his own big band for a couple of decades before taking over as the chief conductor of the WDR big band in Cologne, Germany. Minster highlights the artistry of the band with a new album of original compositions, and we'll hear a couple tracks this evening on Jazz Nightly. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
South Dakota Home Garden offers more opportunities for you to learn during South Dakota's short but sweet growing season. SDPB makes it easier by sharing gardening advice across all our platforms. Join us on TV, radio, and online at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden to keep your gardening ideas fresh this season.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre, now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
Listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. As part of our July spotlight exploring South Dakota history and how it is taught in the state, we brought you news about the planned revision of state social studies standards. Well, what are standards anyway? And who are the people helping determine what those standards are? Today, we're joined by Professor Stephen Jackson of the University of Sioux Falls, and he is with us in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Professor Jackson, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Lori.
And you are one of these people in the room where it happens, working on this process. But let's go back to this first question and say, what is a standard exactly?
Standards are sort of the state way of saying, here's a minimum amount of things that we expect our students to know when they come out of their total K through 12 experience. And also, we have standards for each and every grade level. So we were working on social studies. And I think it's important to say, these are not exhaustive lists of every single thing we expect teachers to do. Rather, they're literally statements of minimums. And the reason we do it that way is so that individual school districts and individual teachers can make a lot of decisions that best suit the needs for their students. So in my table, I worked on world history. That's where my background is. And we have, I think, I want to say 18 total standards. And as you can imagine, if you include all of the history for the last 500 years of the entire globe, there's a little bit more than 18 things that we could have said. But we were mindful very much. We don't, we want to just say, here's the most important things, the critical things that every student has, and then really leaving it up to and trusting teachers and districts to make the decisions that best suit their needs.
And then they are divided down by age appropriateness. Tell me about the anchor standards and grade level standards.
Yeah, so there's two different types of standards. The anchor statements are, anchor standards are those that are basically, this is what, after you graduated from high school, after you've done K through 12 here in South Dakota schools, you come out and you have this set of knowledge. These are things that we expect you to do for the social studies. Grade level standards are each grade, K through 12, has specific things that are age appropriate, that students in elementary school, first grade know this, students in high school world history that I worked on will know these kind of things. So they get a little bit more specific. The anchor statements are kind of broad statements about the whole educational experience.
All right. right? Who is the group of people who are part of this? And again, this is a it comes up every 7 years.
Yeah,
I might have the years wrong.
This is a regular process.
Periodic, yep. Regular process. Yeah.
So yes.
Who's part of this process?
So it was a broad group. There were about 50 of us, not quite 50, I think, and included mostly K-12 educators, so people that are in there in the classroom every day, mm-hmm. so they really know what they're talking about because they're seeing this all the time. People like me, academics and post-secondary educators. We had legislators. We had members of the business community. We had museum experts. So we had a wide array of professionals from a whole lot of different backgrounds, and they came from all over the state. So I was at a table. There's four of us, I think. One was from Yankton. I'm here from here in Sioux Falls. We had somebody from Edgemont, somebody from Spearfish. So a lot of representation from every angle of South Dakotans.
All right. Collaborative or contentious?
Both. It's a highly collaborative process in that the goal and the facilitators, so Melinda Johnson, who works with the South Dakota Department of Education, and Beth Ratway, who works with the American Institutes of Education, they were our facilitators throughout this whole process, and they wanted us to come to consensus. And as you can imagine, I just want, as a thought experiment, if you were to go and ask the next 50 people what are the 18 most important things they need to know about the world over the last 500 years, I'm guessing you'll get about more than 50 answers, right? Because somebody will rethink their answer twice. So it's contentious in the sense that we very much came with our own predispositions and our own ideas and our own thoughts of what we wanted. We also start from what the previous standards do. We're not creating these from scratch. So it's a revision. It's not a make it up yourself. Mm-hmm. So we're also talking to the people that came before us. But there was a sense for the whole group that we wanted the table to come to consensus. And so we spent 8 days kind of talking, discussing about, you know, and coming with all these different perspectives, and then sort of came to conclusions. It was not always an easy process. And in fact, our facilitators instituted this process whereby for each decision you made, for every standard, they gave us red, green, and yellow cards, each of which had a different meaning. So literally we would hold, and I know it sounds really hokey, we're at a table and we're like right next to each other, we're holding up these cards. Red meant that you couldn't support this standard. Yellow meant that you were kind of on the fence, you could go with it if everyone had to. And then green meant, yes, this is the best thing, this is absolutely the best we can do right now for the students of South Dakota. And if you had any yellow or red at your table, our facilitators would say, okay, you need to keep talking. This is not done. Until you get to all green, you need to keep going. And so that's what those 8 days were like, a series of conversations where we're just constantly sort of hashing out. And sometimes it got to really minute levels where we're talking about individual words here or there, which word best suits the particular meaning that we're going for. So it got a little arcane at times. But ultimately, I think that collaboration and that stress on consensus meant that every single person was heard, and that all these different perspectives from so many different places, all of them contributed to the standards that you're going to see released, I think, late next week.
How transparent is this process?
I think about as much as we can make it. All the dates, all of our meeting times were posted beforehand. You can go online right now to the South Dakota Department of Education website. You can see the daily notes, the PowerPoints that we use, that they used when they were talking to us. Every table had its own leader. The leaders gave a report on what your table accomplished that day. That's posted. Everything was there. Even before we got started, the South Dakota Department of Education went out and they asked for public comment. So they solicited this from a wide variety of people, and our work was informed by that comment as well. And then from this point, it now gets to the fun part. Now it goes to the wider public, where everyone is invited to give some feedback on this. And the South Dakota Board of Education is going to host some meetings, four different meetings over the next few months. And I think they'll also probably be soliciting online feedback as well.
Sure. Two people resigned from this after the standards were. What can you tell me about that as far as, you know, resignations from the group? Did you see that coming?
They were not at my table, and I didn't know what prompted the decision or what happened. They did. So I can't speak to their reasons or whatever. All I can speak to is my experience in which points to one very clear fact, which is every single person had every opportunity to speak, to be heard, to have their opinions and their point of view come across. And that process was stressed for every table throughout.
All right. So we talked about next, and we're going to have Secretary of Education Tiffany Sanderson is going to join us in the weeks ahead and help us understand how people can stay informed about the issue. But your advice for people who are continuing to follow this because they care deeply.
So I think my first advice is just to say, don't get angry before you actually look at this. Don't pay. There's so much out there, and there's a national conversation going on about really contentious topics, and there's people that are hurling accusations at one another, and it gets really deep in the mud. Don't pay attention to that. Read the work first. And read what we've come up with. Those will be done next week. They'll be released to the public, so you'll have access to them on the South Dakota Department of Education website. Read that first. Compare it to what we currently have. In many cases, we left a lot of this alone. We made relatively minute changes to others. Sometimes we added some new things. Most of what we added was to include perspectives from Indigenous Native Americans, to have more South Dakota content available in our standards. So read it yourself first, I think, is the most important thing. And then I'd say talk to a teacher. Talk to teachers about what their experience is, how they see these standards, because I think some of the problem that gets translated is some of this stuff is it's in education jargon, and we try to do as good as we could to take some very technical concepts from education and putting it in language we think everybody can understand, but we're not always successful in that. And so sometimes there can be some miscommunication about what we mean with certain terms or those kind of things. So I'd really encourage you, go talk to your local teachers, talk to your children's teachers and what their experience is and what they see with these standards. Go to those things first, and also just sort of keep it all in a perspective. Standards are never perfect.
They're not curriculum.
So they're not like a syllabus like you'd see. Yeah. This is everything that you're going to do every single day. Mm-hmm. They're a statement of minimums. Every district is expected to sort of go beyond this and to really flesh it out into the lesson plans that children will be experiencing daily.
Yeah. Stephen Jackson will have more on the standards revision process as it unfolds. He is associate professor of history at the University of Sioux Falls and was at this group that worked on world history. I would love to be a fly on the wall to find out how you take that massive amount of knowledge and start thinking deeply about what is essential for certain grade levels. You can find all our coverage on this topic online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Ahead on the program, the new women in the Old West. We talk cowgirls, town leaders, and the impact of Western women on American suffrage. Winifred Gallagher is with us. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, the Delta variant and how we should respond. Our guest will be Dr. Lena Wen, an emergency care physician, former Baltimore Health Commissioner, and a CNN medical analyst and Washington Post columnist. Her new memoir is about coming to the U.S. as a poor immigrant from China, relying on the public health system and becoming a doctor. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
The businesses you hear on SDPB support us for a variety of reasons. The key reason is that they recognize that this audience is unique. When your organization is mentioned as a supporter of SDPB, you're telling our loyal, engaged listeners that you care about the things they care about. Our audience pays attention and is more likely to do business with an organization that supports SDPB. We invite your organization to become an underwriter. Email underwrite@sdpb.org and we'll talk.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie, sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities, online at ingallshomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This July, SDPB takes you to summer school as part of our monthly spotlight coverage. Today, we highlight a new book that reveals the untold stories of women in the American West and how they changed the idea of gender decades before suffrage. You can't paint these women with stereotypes, however. These aren't your madams and school marms of lore. Winifred Gallagher's latest book is called New Women in the Old West. I spoke with her this morning.
I started writing the book actually while I was living half-time in Wyoming, in rural Wyoming, and I became very impressed by the women who pretty much ran local affairs, including the 80-year-old mayor. and that's not even counting the cowgirls. And I found out that they were carrying on this long tradition of achievement and independence and civil involvement that was really rooted back in the Old West era of the mid-19th and early 20th centuries. And as I did the research over more than 4 years, I just kept noticing that these women, as you point out, the American history is in the process of an ongoing reformation, and many individuals that had previously been left out, notably women of color, not just gender, but race and class, are getting reincorporated into this new canon. But one group really stuck out that was not being recognized, and they were Western women, and not just the traditional white pioneer wives, but also the Hispanic and Native American women who the white settlers displaced, and the Black and Asian newcomers who, like the white women, were new to the West.
Yeah. Was the research there all along? Tell me a little bit about your process of finding some of these stories, because some of them are just fascinating.
It really was a very diverse effort. I mean, it did take me 4 years, and I looked in all kinds of places. There are lots of things written about, you know, the lady schoolmarm and the hooker with the heart of gold, but there was very little written about the fact that, to me, the most outstanding surprise was that the suffrage movement and the Western expansion happened at the same time. No one ever really talked about that before. And not only that, that some of these women who were busy building homes and communities from scratch actually helped lead that human rights revolution that gave half of America the vote. These Western suffragists were not just, as I mentioned, the cookie-cutter white ladies. They were Native American, Hispanic, Black, Asian. Many of them were single, divorced, or gay. Yet by the time the 19th Amendment that gave women nationwide the vote was passed in 1920, women in most Western states had already voted for years. Some, in Montana and Wyoming and Utah, they had been voting for half a century. But no one seemed to pay attention to that fact, so I became really interested in why that came about.
Let's talk about that a little bit with being on the trail, because when men migrate west, they need an equal partner. Women can't fit into that box, the sort of Victorian or Puritan box that they fit into in some of these Eastern communities. Tell us a little bit about the journey west and why women were so integral to it.
Yeah, as you pointed out, it was impossible for a man. I mean, most of the two groups who went west, they were either miners or farmers, and neither group could do without women's work. Starting with statistics, white men significantly outnumbered white women in the West, particularly in the mining towns, which made women and their work much more valued. One of my favorite stories is the wife who was shocked when she was making breakfast for her family and a miner walking by offered her $5 for a hot breakfast. That's $168 in today's money. And she noted that he would have paid her $10 if she had asked. Women had their pick of suitors. Unhappy wives soon liberated themselves from unsatisfactory husbands in America's first divorce mills. California very quickly led the nation in the number of divorces, many of them sued by women. Women also benefited from life in the West's simpler, more experimental settler society. Every pair of hands was needed to get all the work done. They just didn't have time to worry about whether it was man's work or woman's work. This kind of flexibility enabled women to become more equal by acting more like equals. As in most of America today, it took two economic providers to support a family. Yeah. In new communities, it was often town mothers, not town fathers, who organized the first schools and churches and charities. These hardworking women were not yet considered equal to men, but they narrowed that gap, and they won a lot of respect as a force to be reckoned with.
I am speaking to you from one of those divorce capitals of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That's an important part of our history as sort of the divorce city of this region and beyond. There's personal hardship then, whether it's an abusive husband or a widowed situation or a husband dying along the trail, that spurs some of these women into kind of an activism. And I want to get to that, but I also want to talk about the Homestead Act of 1862 and the Moral Land Grant Act and how important those were to opening doors for women for co-ed education and professions and being able to pay property taxes, which then said, well, if I pay property taxes, shouldn't I be able to help decide where those taxes go? So talk about some of the legislation first that really
That's right. Taxation without representation is tyranny. The federal government was very eager to increase Western settlement, so it offered women some special inducements to migrate. The home was the building block, really, of the whole American expansion to the Pacific. And the government offered tried to lure these potential homemakers. The Homestead Act of 1862 enabled female as well as male heads of households to claim free land. So if you were a single woman, a widow, an abandoned wife, you could get the same 160 acres as a man could claim. That was just an unprecedented economic advance towards equality at the time. Some of the women homesteaders continued on as independent farmers, but I was fascinated to learn that many developed the homesteads and then, as we would say now, flipped them and made a lot of profit and plowed that into their next step up in the world. One of my favorite of the women homesteaders, actually in your neighboring state, North Dakota, she flipped her homestead on the Great Plains, Minna Westby. She was a Norwegian immigrant who arrived in America speaking no English, a servant girl. She filed her homestead claim, flipped it, and put the money into starting her own photography business. So she became a successful businesswoman. I mean, that's the kind of opportunity then that especially for a woman from her social and economic background is almost unimaginable anywhere else. Also, that very same year of 1862, Congress, this was at a time when very few Americans, especially women, went to college, Congress passed the Moral Land Grant Act, which created 90 to 100 tuition-free public colleges. 67 of those were in the West. So that's a real boon to Western development because the West needed engineers and modern farmers trained in the latest agricultural technology and also especially teachers. Mm-hmm. Most of these schools were coeducational. So that was a very radical advance. The Western co-ed land-grant schools were some of the first co-educational colleges in the entire world. This was at a time when women attending college in the East were mostly going to girls' schools like Smith and Vassar and Wellesley. Mm-hmm. So given this career alternative to marriage, many of these Western graduates became teachers, but others, like one of my favorites, Bethenia Owens Adair, she graduated from medical school at the age of 40. And became a doctor. Almost 15% of Western women entered traditionally male professions such as medicine and the law, compared to the national rate of 8%. So that's practically double the number of professional women. That's a real advantage.
Yeah. So there are cowgirls in this book, missionaries and nuns, teachers, waitresses, the Harvey girls get covered here. And you also do, I think, a masterful job at showing the complexity of some of this sort of, you know, women and moral authority, colonization, forced assimilation, their opinions about savagery and faith. And these are some really complicated women of their time who take their passions in different directions. There's not a broad brush that you can paint all these women with.
No, one of the things that really impressed me about them, this was a time of real hardship for a lot of people. But these women used the unique opportunities that the West offered them, which we've discussed a bit, to pursue both women's rights for all women and their own potential in many creative ways. I was really intrigued by Martha Maxwell. She was a 5-foot-tall wife and mother who left the Midwest with her husband during the Colorado Gold Rush. They were quickly impoverished. They had to live in a little shack that the previous occupant had left filled with his stuffed game animals that he had taxidermied. Mm-hmm. She was so intrigued by the beauty of these creatures that she became a highly skilled hunter and naturalist herself, modernized the field of taxidermy, popularized the idea of dioramas so that you would, when you go to a museum, you see a creature in sort of its natural habitat, and created her own natural history museum. This was all like, but you know, by like 1880. I was also very impressed by Helen Hunt Jackson. She was an Eastern socialite, an author. She wrote for The Century and The Atlantic Monthly. She married a wealthy man from Colorado, moved to Colorado, and became really obsessed with the terrible treaty violations that had rendered Native Americans displaced from their lands. She devoted herself to this cause. She wrote a book that she sent to every member of Congress about 100 years of, I think it was called A Century of Dishonor, 100 years of treaty violations. That failed to change legislation, so she decided to turn to fiction, and she wrote the romantic bestseller Ramona, which presented the same civil rights abuses to the public in a more, you know, accessible fictional form. It's a wonderful book. I recommend it to everyone. I read it myself in high school. Mm-hmm. So there were really some remarkable women who used the West's advantages to in very, very creative ways.
Yeah. Here's one of my favorite parts is the women who find out that they're healthier than they've ever been once they're uncorseted on horseback and taking in some fresh air and working. Tell me a little bit about just physically the world they inhabited and then physically how that, because we know there's hardships, certainly, and disease and death, but also some real vigor that some of these women get to discover for the first time in their lives.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things, too. This was at a time when doctors, Harvard authorities were saying that women were these frail vessels and that they were very easily overcome by their reproductive apparatus.
The apparatus, yes.
And that they certainly should not go to college, but if they had to go to college, sure, they should only be allowed to study about a third of the amount of material that a man could, because otherwise they're reproductive.
Hey, Carrie, can you quickly say your name?
So there was just all this hoo-ha about how weak and fragile women were. And in fact, on the migration, which was very tough, this was like 6 to 9 months in a covered wagon in all kinds of weather with your family. It was crazy. 20% of the women were pregnant on the trail, yet women's mortality rate was lower than men's, even counting the dangers of childbirth. Women's diaries are filled with their love of the natural beauty of the West. They felt physically, many of them said they felt better, healthy for the first time in their lives. I think it was probably, you know, the West is drier and sunnier, which takes care of a lot of physical complaints that would have affected people back then. And they also did all this physical work. I mean, most of them were agrarian women. Most of the people who went West in covered wagons were not, you know, society ladies, city slickers. They were farmers' wives and artisans' wives. So they were used to a fair amount of physical labor, but they did even more, and they gloried in it. When they first started the migration, women weren't supposed to do men's work. Was like things like driving the wagons that were being pulled by these, you know, six big oxen or horses. Women weren't supposed to do that work, but very soon everybody decided that the work had to get done no matter who was going to do it, and many women drove the wagons. I mean, this would have been unthinkable in other parts of the country. So, they proved to be, a lot of attention has been paid to the fact that when they had to part from families and friends back east or in the south, and very likely they would never see again, they were, of course, homesick and weepy, and it was pretty miserable. But what was kind of remarkable to me was how quickly they kind of adjusted to this new life and looked forward to their new homes in the West. And these homes generally took about 2 years to really develop so that they were comfortable. So, yeah, there was a lot of hard work involved for sure, and the women were up to the mark.
That's author and historian Winifred Gallagher. Her book is called New Women in the Old West, From Settlers to Suffragists, An Untold American Story. It's available in bookstores now. We'll put a link up on our website at sdpb.org/news. Let's take a moment now to remember David Lust. Former South Dakota House Majority Leader David Lust, who died last week, is remembered by colleagues as an intelligent debater. That was on full display in 2018. He sparred with fellow legislator Mark Mickelson about the effort to limit out-of-state contributions to ballot questions. More than $10 million in out-of-state money poured into campaigns for and against ballot questions in 2016. One of those that passed was Marcy's Law, a voter-approved crime victims' rights law. Former Speaker Mickelson says those debates were challenging and intellectually stimulating. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has this audio postcard from their debate over the First Amendment and the role of out-of-state money in South Dakota politics. First, you'll hear the voice of Mickelson, then Lust.
It's an unanswered question constitutionally, and people support it 2-1. They don't want people from New York or Massachusetts with a set of beliefs that are inconsistent with theirs and who have no vested interest in South Dakota coming into the state and spending money.
So restricting speech has to have a compelling state interest. And the compelling state interest they've found in their speech cases, First Amendment cases, has been the desire to stop corruption, and specifically quid pro quo corruption. So in other words, if I give you a contribution of $50,000, then I expect something back in exchange. So that clearly doesn't exist in a ballot initiative arena.
I believe in free speech, I believe in free enterprise, and I believe in free political discourse. But I don't want to be having that discourse with a puppet, okay, with the strings being pulled out of New York or Massachusetts. It's that simple.
We as a legislature feel compelled to protect South Dakotans from themselves, and that is something that is just absolutely anathema to my views on South Dakota citizens and my confidence in South Dakota citizens and being able to sift through speech, be it out of state or in state, and make a prudent determination.
As lengthy as these ballot measures have become, we saw in this Capitol, this session, where the Marcy's Law people have said, hat in hand, it didn't work, we made a mistake, we'd do it differently if we had a chance to do it again.
Ultimately, I think the Marcy's Law situation demonstrates that our process does work. And whether it's out-of-state money or in-state money, we can fix it. And also, I think the Marcy Law scenario clearly demonstrates that South Dakotans were concerned about an issue. Now, was that issue prompted by out-of-state interest and out-of-state money? Yeah, but it touched a nerve in South Dakota.
Let's resolve our political differences here with people that live in this state.
It's a bit messy. And I think the First Amendment is intended to be messy. There shouldn't be always clear boundaries and lines. A lot of that stuff, it's going to be gray all the time, and you're going to need court interpretation as to what's over the line and what's not. And I think that's the way the First Amendment was structured, and that's the way it's worked historically, and it's worked pretty well historically.
The ban on out-of-state contributions was ultimately deemed unconstitutional by a federal court. Lust died suddenly last Friday night from cardiac arrest. A memorial service is scheduled for Saturday at the Civic Center in Rapid City. David Lust was 53.
I'm Celeste Headlee. The word exotic is often used to describe food, but Washington Post food writer Daniela Galarza says it's a problematic word and we need to stop using it.
I think anytime you use it, you're really centering a white dominant perspective, and particularly one that's maybe Anglo-American.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
After more than a year of missed milestones and important moments shared over video, we at NPR are excited to celebrate our 50th anniversary with you. No special link required, and you don't have to be camera ready. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. Thank you for sharing this special moment with us on the radio, online, wherever you listen. Celebrate every moment. Hear every voice.
SDPB, South Dakota's NPR station for 50 years.
Imagine a South Dakotan who cares about current events and education, who contributes their time and money to help make their community a better place to live. You've just imagined a listener of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. If your company needs to reach well-educated, loyal customers, please consider becoming an underwriter. SDPB is trusted and clutter-free. Your company message doesn't have to be loud or long to get attention here. Our listeners will notice you. Email us, underwrite@sdpb.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Agricultural Heritage Museum in Brookings brings together the diverse history, culture, and science of agriculture through events, exhibits, and collections. Collections coordinator Carrie Van Buren is going to join us now from the SDPB's Janine Basinger Studio at South Dakota State University. We'll talk a little bit about some summer programs at the museum. Carrie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Hello.
Tell us a little bit about what's happening this summer at the Ag Museum in Brookings.
Well, we're just getting programming up and running again from the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So we've had some food truck activities with music throughout the summer, but we're reaching the end of our summer programming, and our last one is August 9th from 2:30 to 5 p.m., and it's a Make and Take Monday. This is a craft project for kids, but our adults seem to enjoy it just as much. And this, on that day, they're doing farm animal scratchers.
Ah, what are we scratching?
Well, I had to ask what scratchers were. If you remember back in school, they'd give you a little... like little boards that were black, sure. And then you'd color on them, and then you'd put another layer of black crayon over the top of that, and then you took a pencil or anything sharp, and you'd scratch a design in it.
So they come
out kind of psychedelic and
the
cute.
Art of the reveal, only with farm animals.
That's right.
Yes.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit. This is a vast history. It's so important to the state. Tell us a little bit about some of the items in the collection. What are some of those, you know, marquee items?
Well, when you first enter the museum, you see our 65 horsepower steam traction engine. Mm-hmm. It's a large monster. You can't miss it. It's about 10 tons of equipment sitting right in front of you.
Wow.
That's probably our, I don't want to say trademark, but it's our, the thing that most people remember when they come into the museum.
Sure. Now, as collections curator, does it move? Do you have to, what do you have to do to maintain this piece of equipment?
Right now, it's pretty much acting like a piece of sculpture.
All right.
We do basically just dust it. It would run if we wanted to fire it up, but it would destroy all the restoration work on it. It has been run on compressed air, and it's checked regularly, so if we ever did want to run it, it would run.
That's a fascinating part of collections curation, is just how you handle these things that are equipment and what some of those rules are. Okay, keep going. What a good time for maybe one more sort of interesting item that people always remember from the Ag Museum in the collection.
Well, one of the things that most people react to in the museum is photographs. When we use them in exhibits and in our exhibit Raising Grain, it's an exhibit about grain elevators in South Dakota, their history and how they work. And the one photograph with the text that we've gotten the most comments on this summer is on the Eureka elevator. It was once one of the world's largest inland grain export terminals.
Yeah.
Just to give you an example, in 1897, they exported 1,231,100 bushels of wheat out of Eureka.
Wow.
That's a lot of wheat.
That is a lot of wheat. And this is a story that is still being told today as we report again and again on agriculture. Do you take new items into the collection, just very briefly?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
It's best if you contact the museum first and let us just talk to us about what you have. We usually ask for pictures of what it is, and it goes through our collections committee. Then we get back to the potential donor and either accept it or, unfortunately, sometimes we have to turn things down.
All right. Keeping that story alive. Well, I want to make sure to tell listeners the South Dakota Agricultural Heritage Museum is located on the campus of SDSU in Brookings. It's at the corner of 11th and Madary, and it's open Monday through Saturday, 10 to 5. Carrie Van Buren, thanks for spending a few minutes with us to talk about the museum and its collections.
Thank you.
Well, music is live on stage again, but there are also some new song releases of note suggested by our music contributor, David Hirsrud. Larry Rohr talks with David Hirsrud from Sturgis. Hirsrud is a former music industry veteran, a collector, and a lifelong music enthusiast.
We're back once again with David Hirsrud from Sturgis. David spent part of his working career in the music industry, but in his heart and soul and his ears, he's never left. Hello again, David.
Nice to be here.
We've got a couple of tracks I describe as guitar-driven that, to me, describe the Tedeschi Trucks Band, and also mentioning one of my favorite songs, Layla, and Layla Revisited.
Yeah, the band, most people don't understand this, but Derek Trucks was named for Derek and the Dominoes. His folks just loved that record. Of course, his father played with the Allman Brothers, and Derek played with them for a lot of years. Layla and Other Love Songs was always a favorite, and so they decided that they would go back and record this in concert. And in fact, it was a very interesting concert because Trey Anastasio from Fish was there that night, and Doyle Bramall was second. This is a 2019 concert, and Why Does Love Have to Be So Bad is the one single that they, or the one song that they have released right now ahead of the album, which is going to be coming out in July. I found it interesting. Layla was released on Susan Tedeschi's birthday in 1970. And of course, as I said, Derek Trucks is named for the album.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a really, really special record for these two people, and they're going to be playing it on their tour, but they're going to be going out, the entire band, you know, playing all over the United States, and they may even be going to Europe. This is a song that people need to hear.
Not always does, like, revisiting some, you know, iconic music, even though there are, you know, connections and so forth through family heritage, that doesn't always work, but this does?
Absolutely. No, I have to agree with you. I've heard some albums where they're trying to do songs of a particular artist or whatever, and you listen to it, and about two cuts in, you're wondering why you even picked it up.
Yeah.
But what I've been able to hear on this, I mean, this is a band that is meant to be heard live. So when you're getting a concert version, you're getting something special. Now, there is one cut that was done in the studio, but the rest of it's all music that was done in concert.
It's a good way to tee up a new tour after a year and a half off. There's no doubt, as soon as you hear about 15 seconds of Jessie Ware's Please from her album What's Your Pleasure, the Platinum Pleasure Edition, that this is a person who has strong disco roots, a really strong rhythm section.
Absolutely. She's an English singer-songwriter, and I've been listening to her stuff for a few years now. This is her fourth album. In fact, the album that this is from is a re-release album with, I think there's six new songs on it, including Please. I want a place where golden moments last forever. Face to face, you look like someone I could treasure. She's quite famous over in England. She and her mother have a podcast called Table Manners, which I understand is one of the more popular podcasts over in England. And the first time I heard this, it's one of those songs you listen to and you want to get up and dance and move around because it really gets to you. And I really like it. The reviews have been extremely favorable.
We're going to go Sitting on Top of the World, the Flatlanders, and this is, how could this not be guitar-driven when you're talking about, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, Joe Ely, and Butch Hancock?
These are three of probably the best-known singer-songwriters in Texas, maybe anywhere else. They've been together as friends and playing since about 1972. They've each gone on to have their own careers as an individual artist, but they get together every once in a while. They've done, believe it or not, they've done about 9 albums. And this is the first album that they've done together in about 12 years, but they've all had varied careers. But every once in a while, these guys get together and start making some absolutely wonderful music. And when I saw Sitting on Top of the World, when it came across my desk, I said, I've got to listen to this. Of the world. Well, I